From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk more about Latin. For a dead language, it sure seems to come up a lot. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. It seems like every week when we talk, Ross is saying something like, well, it's from the Latin. And then we go into some big, long discussion about Latin. So, you know, we may as well come back to one of our favorite topics, which is Latin phrases.
Although, Fletcher, I have to confess, I'm tired of saying it's from the Latin. I mean...
Okay, Ross, I got an idea. Let me start saying it all the time.
I will. I think, but you know, that really reminds me. I think we should do an episode on, like, Anglo-Saxonisms in English. It's really interesting. And it doesn't. We don't have to say it's from the Latin then. How about that?
A whole episode, Latin-free. Well,
yeah, Latin-free episode.
You know it's not
going
to work. Yeah. You know it's going to come off.
And that's definitely not today, because today, yes, we're jumping back to Latin phrases. We do this periodically just because I think there are so many. And, you know, I mean, it's fun, even if it's a little tiresome to talk about Latin so often.
Although I think one of the reasons I think we're doing it, though, is these are phrases that, including me, I must admit, use and say we know, and then you go like, really?
Oh, yeah, okay, all
do
right.
Do I really know it?
That sounds
so this
fun.
Is calling out people like me. This is calling out the posers.
We had get another email in, and Kath, do you want to read it? It was an interesting point.
This is from Christina, who is, I think, in Kansas, and she said, I had a coworker, correct me, more than once, about my dropping of to be from sentences, as in my rug needs vacuumed instead of my rug needs to be vacuumed. I'm a millennial who grew up in Iowa and Kansas and wonder if this is a regional thing or maybe a generational thing. After his pointing out that I did this, I realize I do it all the time and rarely throw in a to be. I know I'm not alone because I hear plenty of other people do it. So the question is, what's with that? Why the dropping of to be?
And Fletcher, another question is, because presumably you grew up in Kansas as well as live there now, do you do that?
Turns out I do. Right before we got this email, well, I realized it when we got this email that earlier that day I had said, boy, the car really needs washed.
Wow.
I do it.
Eek, really?
Yeah, I do it.
And Fletcher,
I think I do it fairly often, honestly.
You just said, Fletcher, when you said the car needs washed, you just stated exactly
right.
What the Yale Grammatical Diversity Project, which studies different dialects across America, and they call the dropping of the to be the needs washed phenomenon. Isn't
oh,
that
no.
amazing?
It is amazing. It is so perfect. You couldn't have made this up. Truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, I didn't know I was so typical. I don't know. Is that unfortunate?
So you're predictable.
And I'm going to ask you one more question, Fletcher. Your background, I mean, from in Europe, where does your family come from by any chance?
Oh, largely the British Isles.
Okay, but like north or south? Just curiously.
You know, I mean, I think we're all over.
Okay. Well, the Irish and Scottish part is very good.
Yeah, okay.
Because apparently this dropping of the to be comes from dialects in Northern Ireland and Scottish English.
Oh. Mm.
It's a construction that comes from there, and it's basically now used mostly in the Midwest. Missouri, Illinois, Michigan, Lower Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, parts of Pennsylvania, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee. But apparently it spreads out there, too.
Yeah, that's more of the influence then, isn't it? It's not so much that my ancestors may have been mm-hmm. Irish or Scottish, but rather...
Oh, yeah. No, I was just curious if you actually hit a trifecta on that.
I love the fact that somebody, I was looking on a linguistics exchange board where people just talk about different topics, said this is a person who grew up in Scotland and said the needs washed sounds entirely ordinary. The construction, your car needs washing, sounds pompous.
Wow.
To them, which I think is just fascinating that what we consider the correct version is considered by them be like, oh, come on.
Wait a minute. Your car needs washing is correct to you?
Yeah, your car needs washing. It needs to be washed.
That sounds fine to me.
Yeah. Wow.
They're saying that's pompous.
That does sound a little weird to me. It needs washing.
That's fascinating.
A little. I'm not sure if I would think of it one way or another if somebody said it. But now that you're saying it next to needs washed, it sounds a little weird to me. Yeah. Needs washing doesn't
that's
sound
so
quite right.
Interesting. Whereas needs wash sounds really weird to me. Does it to you, Kathy?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, it's fine to say it, but I would stop if I heard that. If I heard someone say your car needs washing, I would, you know, go, yeah, it does. It always does. But that's, you know, I would hear it and process it.
Yeah. I mean, you're not the only ones, because this is definitely not the first time this has come up on this show. We've had letters about this before.
I must say, though, I had never run across it until we started doing the show. People writing in about it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But you know something? Right now, I hear the march of Roman legions.
Well, I think CrossFit needs discussion.
Well,
which I think needs discussing.
It needs discussed.
That's it. Oh. See, I still don't get it. Yes, we're talking about Latin phrases we often use in English and pretend to understand.
But do we really know what they mean? And when we say we, Fletcher, we're talking about you. So here we go with a quiz. We're going to first do the first famous phrase that you may have seen in various television and film. Habeas corpus.
Oh, habeas corpus. Yeah. So are we looking for a literal translation here?
Well, first we're going to ask you, what does it mean technically? What does having a habeas corpus do? One. It refers to the guarantee an inmate has the right to appear before a judge in court. Two, it refers to a body being present at a crime scene, hence an indictable offense for murder or manslaughter. Or three, it refers to a body, i.e. a person, being present at a crime scene, hence able to be arrested for said crime.
So are you asking what does it mean for us here in the United States?
Yes.
I guess it's being able to appear before the judge. It's due process.
You got it, Fletcher.
Literally, though, it does mean something like here is the body or something like that, right?
Fletcher, you are a Latinist at heart. You're right.
And a jurist, I'd like to add.
Yeah, habeas is a second person singular subjunctive, habere, to have. So you have... corpus is body. You have the body.
So back way up on that then, what did it mean when it started?
Well, I mean, it basically came literally, I mean, you know, I mean, the Latin is just words. And it came in the mid-1500s. Literally, you should have the person. You should have the person there. And it was used in Anglo-French documents from that time period. And that's when you don't find habeas corpus. You might find it somewhere in some Latin book or whatever from, you know, 800, but you basically find it literally with that phrase in the mid-1500s, mid-1400s.
Basically doing the same thing it does for us here?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it meant that person could be brought before a court or judge to see if he was being legally detained.
Yeah, okay.
It's that simple.
Okay.
This is one, the next one is one that has always stumped me a little bit, because I have seen it a fair amount, and I do know what it means now. Sui generis.
Oh, yeah.
Does it mean unusually intelligent, i.e. a genius, to generic, well, unusually generic? No, it wouldn't be unusually generic, simply generic. Three, unique. Sui generis. Sui generis.
Now, I don't know if this phrase has come up on this show before, but it has been within, let's say, the last 5 years or so that I learned what this meant. This was always one of those phrases that I would see and sort of just jump right over when I was reading something.
Mm-hmm, me too.
Yeah, I would do the same thing. I would exactly do what you did. You're just going to flip over it. Yep. It means something. Keep going.
Yeah, pretty much. And I just try to get the idea of what was happening from all the other words in that sentence or paragraph. But I think it means unique, right? There's nothing else like it.
Correct. Yeah.
You got it.
Well, because it comes from sui of its own and generous kind. It's of its own kind.
And this, frankly, I mean, we had an example from a book a while back in LA Magazine from the Irish-Brit writer-director of 2008's Neglected in Bruges comes this sui generis chronicle of doomed characters. Now, I don't really think we need to have sui generis in there. This unique chronicle would be fine for me.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you all
think?
Oh,
there's so many examples. I mean, this always reminds me of George Orwell. We've talked about him when we were talking about the Norman stuff, didn't we? When he said that bad writers are haunted by the notion that with Latin or Greek, I think, were grander than Saxon. And it's true. Unique is just dandy. I don't think we really need this, like, fancy fanciness. It really makes me want to punch someone. I mean, honestly.
Well,
the writer
I'm not as
or the
violent
speaker.
As Kathy. I would go more. I would go just more. Why don't you use unique instead?
Would you say something like something is more sui generis than something else? Just like we now.
Oh, we talked about that a long time ago with unique. You're right. That's a good point. That's
I think I'm
going to
start using that construction all the time now. That'll show up.
Okay, Fletcher, our next one, I think you're going to know the Latin. It's E pluribus unum.
E pluribus unum, something along the lines of out of many, one.
You're right.
You know, a lot of this, I got to say, a lot of this is just civic education. It's not even necessarily knowing Latin.
That's true, because the Romans and Latins, basically our founding fathers, they kept rereading all these classics, which I think I've said before reminds me of, speaking of George Orwell, when he was a kid years ago, he learned about how the Great Library of Alexandria was burnt down. No one exactly knows who did it or when. And he thought the professor was going, what a tragedy this is, the teacher was saying. And Orwell remembers thinking, no, I don't think so. That's a lot fewer Latin and Greek, dull Latin and Greek things we have to read.
Wow.
I like George.
But anyway, the first time E pluribus unum was used, actually, this is technically incorrect. I'll say it in a minute. It was used to describe, one, a salad, two, a smelting pot.
No, it should have been melting pot.
A melting pot. You wrote smelting, though. That was one of them said smelting.
I was doing something about smelting. I think I said it in Scrabble. I'm not kidding.
I think it was like iron smelting or steel, whatever. And three, a motto for a magazine. So one, we have a salad. Two, we have a melting pot. Three, we have a motto for a magazine.
A salad. Absolutely a salad.
And Fletcher, you have it, but there's a slight problem with this.
Wait, it really is a salad?
Yes.
Well, it's a salad dressing.
Okay. It's just like you have a lot of ingredients and you make one thing out of them?
Yeah.
The salad dressing.
Uh-huh, right.
The problem is not to be, don't hit me when I say this, but it's originally the original usage, but this does not necessarily mean it came from that. That was the first time we saw it. And there was a poem attributed to Virgil called the Moretum describing, they say a salad dressing here, but it's really more like a, it's like a mixture, it's like a pesto or with cheese in it, a mixture of cheese with, and in the poem, he's talking about grinding all these things together, cheese and, you know, whatever stuff. And out of that, you make a unique...
Excuse me, Ross, you'd make a sui generis salad.
Ah, very good. However, in Virgil, I'm equating Fletcher with Virgil now, Fletcher. That's
very
flattering. But he says e pluribus, and then there's a new line, and it's unus, not unum. So whatever, that's just a minor technical point. We don't think it really came from that salad dressing. It was the first time it was used. It could have come from the Gentleman's Magazine.
No, it was like, the Gentleman's Magazine used that as their motto.
Yeah.
However, they got it from Virgil.
Oh, I didn't know that, Kathy. I didn't know the Gentleman's Magazine got it from Virgil. That's interesting.
Yes, that is why I wrote those very tough clues.
It wasn't written in Latin, so I couldn't read it. Anyway. no, that's interesting. But so then the U.S. probably got it from the Gentleman directly from the Gentleman's Magazine, I would imagine.
Correct. I mean, it was a very big thing at that time. It was like the cool thing to say, kind of like saying like faux shiz many years ago or skibbity.
Basically the same thing. So that's what we'll end up on our money or whatever in a couple hundred years, faux shiz.
Okay. Ross, you have to pronounce these because I don't have the pronunciation.
Well, I'm going to pronounce it in American or in British because we're talking British. We're not talking Latin. Even though the phrase is memento mori, we would say probably. It would be
That's what I thought.
But it'd be memento mori probably in Latin because the I had an E sound in Latin. Oh. But anyway.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard it said out loud. And whenever I've read it, I've always read it memento mori to myself.
Oh, really?
I always thought mori. Okay, you're better than I.
So you're going to surely know the definition.
I can never quite remember. This is one of those. This is not exactly one of those that I gloss over when I read it, but more mm-hmm. like I'll look up what it means and then instantly forget it. And so I can't mm-hmm. I can't remember offhand what it means.
This is a tough one. I'm not sure, Ross, if we have the best clues here because they kind of overlap too much.
They do. I think we'll just ask Fletcher. Let's see if he can tease out the meaning here.
Well, I'll just give him the three, but they kind of overlap. We had one, memory of those dead. Mm-hmm. So you're remembering mm-hmm. dead people. Mm-hmm. Two, a memorial for the dead people. Three, a reminder that we're all going to die.
Well, okay, those are...
impending death.
Those are all along the lines of what I was thinking, which was it had something to do with memory and something to do with death. So really helpful. Good. Really helpful there, guys. I thought it was something that helped us to remember it.
Very good.
Is it like a monument then?
No, it's like sort of, I mean, it could be a monument, but you could make monument in a very tiny little thing.
Yeah.
It's more of a reminder of impending. In Petronius, I'm not sure they had it in the film, Fellini's Satyricon. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's famous, and there's an episode in the book, and I thought in the movie, where they pass around like a little skeleton type thing to remind you that, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you will die. I mean, literally, it means remember you will die.
So technically, the right answer is the third. It's a reminder that we're all going to die. But
yes.
But that's where I didn't like our clues. Because, I mean, really, it could also be a memorial to someone. Like, I'm here as a picture of somebody. Couldn't that be a memento mori?
No, because technically, I mean, this sounds really getting rid of much. But the memento is a second person singular imperative. So it's saying you must
remember. You must die.
Remember. Yeah, you will die. It's telling you. I mean, it's informing you that it's basically saying, look, guy, remember. So that sense, it is more the imperative. So it's in that
but
sense.
But tech, I mean, like, I'm looking at like ossuaries, they say, were considered memento moris.
They were. I know. But I'm saying it could be technically you're right. But I'm saying it really means. It's more of that.
Well,
whatever.
But I mean, like you go to an ossuary. Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like you're seeing just a whole bunch of bones. That's going to remind you that you're going to die.
Yeah.
Unless you're like rushing through it to go to dinner, you know.
You're probably not going to like, you know, this femur and remembering whoever it belonged to. You're probably looking at the whole big thing and being reminded
you're
going to die.
Yeah. But it's not saying, I remember a poor old Teddy.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Saying more like Teddy, you're going to go to.
I think it would be Tedus, Ross.
Yeah, I know.
So the winged skull and all that, those are memento moris. Moris.
But they're telling, it's sort of like the Kathy and I were walking in New York, and we remember that? We saw that.
The
grave.
Death bee. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, stop passenger as you walk by.
As you walk by, I am now, as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, soon you will be. Prepare for death and follow me.
Kath, I kept saying it over and over, really annoying our spouses at the time.
We were.
And then we switched it over to follow the death bee, which infuriated both
your
wife.
We found the death bee hysterical. No one else did.
No one else did.
This one we've done in the past, so we're going to just ask you to use it in a sentence. Quid pro quo.
Quid pro quo, Clarice.
That's a sentence.
I'll give you this if you give me that.
Yeah, this one, I have a question for you guys with this. This one to me, you know, I'm against basically using all these Latin phrases, but this one I think is really useful. I would use this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, because it instantly hits me as, I'm not reading it as the Latin, I'm just reading it as like, it's a kind of fair exchange type thing. I think it works really well. I would use this.
Well, isn't it, you scratch my back, I'll scratch... No, it's not even completely that, because scratching the back implies just scratching the bat, if you will. This is... Yeah, no. you're getting something of equal merit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't say I scratched his back, so I want him to scratch mine. I'd say I want a quid pro quo for what I did for him. I think quid pro quo perfectly.
It's three syllables and it tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though. Would you just use that casually? It feels like it generally has a negative connotation these days.
Ooh.
That's interesting because I would use it casually. I don't know that I have. Yeah, it's just a quid pro quo. I don't think of it as negatively. That's interesting.
No, I don't either, actually.
Tit for tat, I guess you would say instead, and that seems less loaded.
Yeah, but tit for tat sounds dumb, I think, really.
Yeah, I think quid pro quo is fine, and if it's good enough for Hannibal Lecter, it's good enough for me.
Okay, next. Cui bono.
Cui bono. Is that spelled C-U-I?
It can be Q-U-I or C-U-I.
Okay.
Bono.
Okay.
It can be either one. One is an older form of the other.
Okay, what does it mean? One, how you doing? Good? Bono? I don't think that we'd have that accent, though. But anyway. Two, what purpose or end do you have in doing this? Three, what's in it for me?
Qui, does it mean maybe why? Why is it good? What's in it for me? That's it. It's the last one.
You got it. Qui, in this case, is the dative to whom or to who profits by it. The good, bono is good. To whose good is this for?
Okay. Yeah. Who's this good for?
To what good purpose? For what use or end? Who profits by this is basically what it means.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is one that I have seen, and it's one that I never thought about. You know what I mean? This is one, like you were saying before with, I forget which one, that you blip over. This one, definitely. I don't see it often, and I think when I do, I don't really care. You know, I just go like, whatever.
Oh, I saw this. I just realized where I saw it. I saw it in reference to the tariffs. And they were talking about tariffs and they go, qui bono, you know, who do these tariffs benefit or something like that. So, I sort of agree with Kathy. I mean, you could just say who benefits by this.
Yeah, if you hadn't given me options, I wouldn't have known what that meant. I mean, I know bono means good, but that wouldn't have helped me, really. I wouldn't have known.
Mm-hmm. No, nor I.
I don't think it's a particularly big deal either, you know? I mean, why can't you just say who benefits?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, again, we go back to, I think, like so many people, like, a la Orwell, using the Latin just to sound like kind of like, you know, smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it unnecessary. And because to me, the presumption is, well, of course we all know this, and they know perfectly well that a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I object to the use of the phrases.
Okay, let's go.
Alma mater, that means literally nurturing mother, right? It was a title given by Romans to certain goddesses.
Well, I didn't know that. I knew the mater meant mother, but I didn't know what the alma meant. Nurturing.
Yeah, alma is nurturing. Almas is the masculine, but whatever. Let's keep going.
In what century did alma mater begin being used to mean one's university or school? 1300s, 1700s, 300s, for 1900s. Alma mater.
1900s.
Well, close, but it's the 1700s.
Okay. Wait, is it the 1700s or the 17th century?
The 1700s.
Oh, okay.
1710 was the first time it was found.
My gut feel was that it was in the 1700s, but I thought Kathy said 17th century, so that 1600s didn't seem quite right to me.
Wow. Okay, so you got it right.
I didn't, but...
Let's skip ahead a little bit, Fletcher. Let's do some more university stuff. You're graduating from Oxford.
Why not Harvard?
Okay, I like Oxford because it's the British, the 1700s, the British did the alma mater. His alma, Fletcher's alma mater is now Oxford. Okay.
Wow, thank you.
And you've graduated and you basically are about to get your degree. I'm not even sure Oxford did this. Harvard does, but whatever.
That's why I said Harvard.
Okay. Okay. Fletcher is graduating from Harvard in the 1700s. Okay. Fletcher, do you want to be cum laude?
All right.
Do you want to graduate magna cum laude or do you want to graduate summa cum laude?
I'm sorry, Ross. No, he's graduating in the 1800s, okay?
Kathy's right. Kathy just found something horrifying for me. 1872 was when Harvard basically introduced cum laude, magna cum laude, and summa cum laude. So Fletcher, you're very old undergrad. You were in the 1700s, and now you're doing it over and over again. You finally are graduating in 1872.
I think the best one is summa. Is that right?
Very good.
Okay. And so magna must mean like big with honors. And summa great must praise. Mean like the summit with honors.
Excellent.
Yay!
You did it.
Yes.
Fletcher, you truly are a summa cum laude graduate of Harvard.
I mean, okay, so did they just, I mean, is this just basically, let's sound real fancy? What can we do to sound really fancy?
Uh-huh.
To be fair, though, the one thing about those schools was in those days, you basically, you know, you were steeped in Latin and ancient Greek. Basically, that was the idea of a, you know, when they started doing things like practical languages like Italian or German, they're like, oh, it's horrible. So,
all right. How can we introduce that into our curriculum?
Yeah.
I like, want to go to Alibi?
Okay, yeah, let's do Alibi. This is really interesting, Fletcher.
Alibi, right. An alibi is the story that you use to show people that you did not commit some crime.
Okay, which one here is really an alibi?
Really an alibi.
Yes, okay. We have a lawyer saying it. My client couldn't have killed him. He was in a wheelchair and was absolutely incapable of walking across the room with the candlestick. Okay, we're a little bit in Clue as well. But anyway. My client couldn't have killed him. He was in the drawing room and the victim was in the bedroom.
Oh, yeah.
My client couldn't have killed him. According to witnesses, he was passed out on the couch.
Okay, I think I always thought an alibi actually had to do with other people. So I'm going to go with the witnesses saw him passed out on the couch.
And Fletcher, for the first time, I think in this entire show, you are wrong.
Oh no, sic transit gloria.
Very good. Very
nice.
Thank you.
No, this is, Ross and I were fascinated by this. An alibi technically is you're somewhere else. It's not an excuse. An excuse is one thing, or saying like, you know, evidence that proves you were, it's that you were not physically there. So yes. My alibi, if I'm to right now, if one of you dies, my alibi is that I'm in Armenia and you guys aren't. So yeah. I'm off the hook.
Wow. Okay.
I never knew that.
Yeah. It comes from alias other or another and then ibi place. So it's another place.
Another place. Wow. Okay, cool.
And I knew the wording of it, but we looked it up on like, this was a Canadian law site, but they all say, I don't know if it's the case elsewhere in the world, but in all cases, at least in Canadian law, you have to be in another place for the alibi to be an alibi.
Fascinating.
They say that the use of it as an excuse, I mean, colloquially, has been used since the 1900s. So, I mean, like, so our use of alibi is what you know, most people think of. But now I want to just double check in the United States if legal meaning somewhere other than the scene of the crime. That's the U.S.
Yeah.
too.
No, it's so interesting. Because I would use it really colloquially as like my alibi is, you know, like I was passed out on the couch. I mean, you know, not that
it's
I would ever be
here,
passed
huh?
out on the couch. Yeah.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petras records from her home in Armenia, Spain. Ross Petras from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetras@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.